I must say, after having listened to Sarojini, I almost feel like wanting to be silent and just think about it and just let it sit. But I, at the same time, do want to share with you some thoughts about Desmond Tutu's heritage, I would say, not about the features of his theology, you know them quite well, but about my own encounter with Desmond Tutu and his legacy and what I draw from it for my own role now as the Bishop of Bavaria, but as a Christian, as an involved Christian. My relationship to Desmond Tutu, and I've said some words about it in the book Sarojini talked about. It began quite early in my youth already because my mother was one of the women who got engaged against the fruits of apartheid. There was this German church women's initiative that tried to boycott the buying of fruit in order to share or to contribute from Germany to the struggle against apartheid. So that was something that accompanied me in my youth. And my mother was a role model for me in the struggle against injustice in this role. And then later at the university, when I was the assistant of Wolfgang Huber, who might be quite well known amongst you as well, when he was professor of social ethics at the Faculty of Heidelberg, we had guests from South Africa many times, and I always got first hand information about the situation. And of course, Desmond Tutu was always present in all these conversations. And then my first encounter with a personal encounter with Desmond Tutu was in Berkeley. That's the story I tell in the book, because it's really so present to me until this day. I studied at Berkeley at the Pacific School of Religion, studied theology, and there was the student protest that tried to bring the University of California board to divest from companies who made business with South Africa. And I participated in a demonstration where Desmond Tutu was the speaker. And I have been at many demonstrations in my life, but I still remember very well the slogan that were shouted. What do you want? Divestment. When do you want it? Now. That is a melody that's still very much in my head, in my heart. And now the same melody is used by the young people who are protesting against the climate change. So it's something that entered my soul, that demonstration. And when he spoke, I will never forget the way he spoke. He spoke with such a love of life, with such a passion, and also with such love towards us. We were standing there, and he said, as God looks down on you today, he's saying, hey, have you seen my children in Berkeley? Hey, don't you think that they're something else? That is what he said. And he smiled at us, and you can all picture his face saying things like that. It impressed me very much. And I remember when I took office as a bishop of Bavaria 10 years ago, some journalist asked me, and I was not prepared to answer that question, who is your role model as a bishop? And never having thought about it, actually, my spontaneous answer was Desmond Tutu. That is how important Desmond Tutu has been for me, even though my personal encounters with him then came later. That is why it's such a joy for me and such an honor for me that I can today speak to you and speak about the legacy of Desmond Tutu. I have given, as the others, I've given a title to my presentation, and I've called it Tutu's Theology, Prophetic and Public. I've spoken on public theology many times, but in this case, I want to speak about a prophetic public theology, even though the prophetic aspect is an important aspect of public theology in my own thinking. But in this case, it deserves to have a special emphasis. And I want to talk in two parts. The first one is on prophecy, and the second one is then on the role of public theology. So let me begin with the character of prophetic speech. I came up with seven dimensions, characteristics of what I think are important for prophetic speech, prophetic theology, looking at what I have heard and seen and read from Desmond Tutu. The first dimension has been mentioned already, but I want to emphasize it again, that prophetic witness, it's obvious, but it has to be said, can never be neutral. It can never be simply in a moderating position. Sorogeny has just emphasized it very well. It is always motivated by a passion for justice. That is crucial for prophetic theology. And of course, that understanding of justice is shaped by and grounded on the preferential option for the poor. That is why prophetic theology, as theology in general, can never be neutral. I do not have to elaborate on that, because I think it is very clear and has been already elaborated before. Then the second dimension, prophetic speech in a biblical perspective is what Michael Walzer, the American philosopher, has once called connected criticism. The prophet is a connected critic. That is his definition of the prophet. It is something very true and valuable for me as a church representative who has been in contact and is in contact with many people who actually bear concrete political responsibility. It's prophecy is based on relationship. When you look at the stories of the prophets, you can always, for example, the Nathan parable, when Nathan comes to the King David, and then at the end of his parable, he says, "You are the man who has done injustice." That comes out of a relationship. And the king listens to him because there has been a relationship. It's not about getting your frustration off your heart and attacking a person or something. It's about the passion for justice that you speak up about in relationship. That's why I think it's important. And I see so many examples in the life and work of Desmond Tutu, where that is exactly the key, that he has been in relationship to the powerful, even though it has been a critical relationship in many times. Then the third aspect, is something that might be controversial, but I think for me, that is part of the understanding of prophecy. It is always connected with a reflection on the consequences for political change. I have already said, prophecy is not about just getting, relieving your heart with your frustration. Prophecy always has the goal of changing injustice and of discerning the spirits about what must be done and what must be sharply and firmly criticized. So radical statements in itself for me are not already prophecy, but statements that really create a possibility of opening up hearts, making people think about a certain question, and therefore inducing change. I think that is an important part of prophetic witness. Saying this, I should, as a fourth dimension, also say that prophetic voices need not always be constructive. I admit that for me, that aspect, that it must be constructive, has always played a big role. But I've come to the conclusion that it can be sometimes simply expressive in the sense that you voice a deep anger or sadness about an injustice that you see that does not already think about what comes out of it. But this momental expressiveness of prophetic speech must always be put in the frame that I've described before, that you think about what can help changing this situation. It's not about you as the prophet. It's about changing the situation and overcoming injustice. Because prophetic speech bears a certain danger of, I would now even go so far and call it narcissism, that you find yourself so great in your speech that it begins to be about you instead of about overcoming the injustice. That is a form of self-reflection that is important for prophets, I think. Then the fifth dimension, the prophetic speech, I think its role is very clear in situations of dictatorship, in situations where you simply need to speak out and highlight justice. It's much more complicated in a democratic society when there are different voices where the discourse plays a central role for finding the best way of acting politically. So the question is, what is the role of prophecy in a discourse-based democratic society? I think there is a strong role for prophecy. I think there is something like an ecology of consciousness in a dynamic civil society. You need to reach out to the hearts of people in what is morally true and what is not. And you need to sharpen the consciousness, but also the heart consciousness or the soul consciousness of people in a democratic society just as much as in a dictatorship. And there the prophets have a strong role to really make clear what can be said publicly and what cannot be said publicly. The discourse in a democratic society sometimes is in danger of, because everyone can express his or her opinion, in danger of losing a certain fundamental moral consensus that human dignity cannot be discussed. Human dignity must be emphasized and must be passionately defended. And when you see situations where human dignity is at stake, you need to say it very clearly. You need a prophetic voice who makes sure that this is not a matter of discourse. So that is a very important role in a democratic society, like especially in societies where right-wing populism is on the rise, where they try to shift the democratic consensus or the societal consensus away from certain fundamental values that cannot be at stake, like human dignity. And that has to do, I talked about dictatorship and democratic societies. And in South Africa, you have seen that shift, and you're still struggling just as many others. And even us in Germany, who have had this democratic system for a while, we need to defend democracy and to rediscover democracy constantly. And that's why liberation theology and public theology are no opposition. They are, for me, that's the title of my book on liberation theology. Public theology is liberation theology for a democratic society. The impulses of liberation theology, which were gained in societies like in Latin America that were dictatorships, they must be transformed into the situation of democratic societies where everyone has the possibility by vote or by participation in civil society to participate in the societal discourse and then introduce those impulses from liberation theology, such as the preferential option for the poor, and win the hearts and souls and heads of people for these contents. So the result of the elections is in a way that these contents can really be put into practice in a political process. And that is, of course, a different situation. When you are in a dictatorship situation, prophecy means you need to really denounce the injustice. When you are in a democratic society and are even in government, you've made it to the government position with your liberation theology impulses in your heart, then of course you are in a different situations. You have to make compromises. You have to find majorities for a certain political content. And you must think about how you can change politics with those impulses in your heart. That daily political task, I want to say that very clearly, that daily political task for me is on an equal moral ground with prophetic witness. Prophetic witness is not given from a moral high ground towards those who are in those down grounds of political reality. I think both are needed. Those who sometimes speak very clearly with a prophetic voice, and those who try to put that into practice and to really make sure that change can come and is possible. So this duality of this dual approach of prophecy and political practice is, I think, very important. I do not see, as a church person who sometimes has to speak prophetically, I do not see politicians as my enemies or as people who are in the dirty ground. I see them as allies. And I hope that the contents of prophetic witness can be put into practice in politics. And we are now witnessing the climate change conference in Glasgow. And that is exactly the situation where this must be seen. We need Greta Thunberg, but we also need those cabinet ministers who are assembled there. And I just wish them God's blessings to come up with a solution that's the product of a long negotiation process with many compromises, with a solution that goes as far as possible. So that is why I see them as allies. So let me speak about public about three tasks of public theology, and I will make that short enough so I do not take more time than I have. I have three tasks that I just want to explain briefly: the enlightening task, the orientation task, and then I've already said that political enablement tasks. What is the enlightening task of public theology? And I think we as churches have a strong role to play in this when we are involved in political discussions. The enlightening task is simply identifying the moral issues in all those public discussions that seem to be so technical at first sight. Just to give one example, for example, the gross national product has always been the indicator of whether a country is more well off after a year than the year before. And the news speaker in the TV news, when you see it going up, the graph going up with the gross national product, you think, well, now we're better off again as a country. It completely ignores who is more well off. Because if the average gross national product has risen, it can be that the poor are worse off than before. So this figure doesn't tell us anything about distribution, about the situation of the poor. But we generally think that we as a country are more well off. So our task as theologians, as church people, is to identify the moral issue behind this number. And the moral issue is, of course, the preferential option for the poor. If we measure the wealth of a country, we look at the least advantaged. and we see whether in the last year, the position of the least advantage has improved. That for us is the criteria for the wealth of the country. So if we introduce that in the public discussion, I think we are enlightening the public discussions. All those people in the disciplines of science who think that they are objectively telling the truth need to know, and that is our task, that whatever facts they come up with is to be put in a context that has a moral quality. And it needs to be put in the context where we give an answer to the question, what is the goal of the economy? Making the rich richer, making the average income higher, or improving the situation for the poor? And I think our answer must be clear, the third one. That is the enlightening task. And then the second, yes?
Your time is running out.
My time is over.
Yes.
Okay. Then the orientation task is biblical content, giving orientation with the values that a society struggles with. And then it's only one sentence, political enablement task. I've already described it when I spoke about prophetic theology. So that's why I can end at this point. But I just want to highlight again that with everything I have tried to say, I want to celebrate Desmond Tutu's prophetic public theology. Thanks, Simone, for reminding me of the time.